Good morning, Chief Judge Easterbrook, Judge Wood, and Judge Hamilton. For the record, I'm Alfred Lurie of the firm Kilpatrick, Townsend & Stockton, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the appellant, Elliot D. Levin, the trustee in bankruptcy for Irwin Financial Corporation. May it please the court, counsel. This is an appeal from a final judgment entered by the United States District Court for the Southern District of Indiana, dismissing with prejudice the seven-count complaint filed by the appellant against three former executive officers of Irwin Financial Corporation, an Indiana corporation that I'll refer to for simplicity's sake as IFC.
I'd appreciate it if you would refer to it using English words.
How about the holding company?
Yeah, that'd do nicely.
The holding company, all right. I'll refer to it as the holding company. Yes, sir. Until September 18, 2009, the holding company was a multi-bank holding company that owned two banks headquartered in Indiana. On that date, the banks were closed by their respective regulators, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation was appointed as receiver for each. The holding company filed a voluntary petition under Chapter 7 of the Bankruptcy Code that same day.
I think, a pretty good sense of what happened. With respect to some of the claims, so for example, Claim 1, I think Claim 2 is the same, your complaints appear to relate to things that, inadequate risk management processes at the bank level that these defendants couldn't have done in wearing their hat as officers of the holding company. And the FDIC makes this point in its brief repeatedly. So there are a set of claims, all except 3 and 7, I think, that are like that. So isn't it pretty clear that if they couldn't even have done anything about it, this would be a derivative claim?
Your Honor, we don't believe that that's the case with respect to Count 1. Count 1 asserts that the defendants, in their capacities as senior executive officers of the holding company, failed to cause an enterprise-wide integrated risk management system to be put in place.
They failed to protect the holding company from their own malfeasance at the banks. Would there have been any loss to the holding company had there not been any loss at the banks?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So the loss is derivative. It derives from the loss to the banks. Which of the claims that you're advancing don't depend on loss to the banks?
The claims that we're asserting that don't depend on loss to the bank, Your Honor, are the claims in Count 7 and the claims in Count 3. The claims in Count 7 are claims for the making of capital contributions by the holding company to the bank at a time when there was no realistic possibility that the banks would succeed. And there was no injury.
To use lay language, you're saying that the directors threw good money after bad.
Yes, Your Honor. The directors threw good money after bad. We believe that the claims that are asserted in Count 7 are analogous to a situation where a freight handler places cargo.
What about the claim that Miller hired a useless consultant? I think you've done that as count
that.
Six.
We've withdrawn count six, Your Honor, and count six. We acknowledge that it's been dismissed with prejudice.
Okay.
All right. So, but let me go back. I think there's an important difference in the test that people are talking about here. One possibility would be to look at this the way Chief Judge Easterbrook just articulated it, and I think this is what the FDIC says, which is to say, are there any losses in any of these counts that would have incurred, that the holding company would have incurred independent of the losses at the banks? And I think the answer is no. All of these things, failure to implement effective internal controls, failure to develop non-volatile sources of liquidity, et cetera, these all lodge in the banks. A different way of looking at it is to say, which things were under the control of the holding company without regard to the banks, like due diligence investigations of the investments it chooses to make, and which things are not under its control. For example, what kinds of diversification the banks have in terms of their own portfolios and the like. And there, I think, only counts 3 and 7 are describing things that might have happened at the holding company level. But I think the fundamental question is, what's the correct legal test for us to be applying as we try to sort out what's direct and what's derivative?
Yes, Your Honor. And, Your Honor, I believe that there's a consensus that the law of Indiana controls as to whether or not a claim that's asserted
right.
by Irwin Financial Corporation constitutes a derivative claim or a direct claim. And the most authoritative articulation of the test by an Indiana State appellate court is the test that was articulated by the Indiana Court of Appeals in Price Waterhouse versus Massey. And in the Price Waterhouse case, citing to principles of corporate governance, the Indiana Court of Appeals stated that a claim which can be sustained by a shareholder without showing an injury to or a breach of duty to the corporation should be treated as a direct claim. Clearly, the making of capital contributions to the bank was not a breach of fiduciary duty to the bank. The bank benefited from the capital contributions, and clearly,
the bank is just an investment. The holding company has assets. They happen to be called Bank 1, Bank 2, Bank 3. Yeah, actually, Bank 1 and Bank 2, and then various subsidiaries. But those are assets. So you need to show that this is about the holding company's management of its assets, whether they happen to be banks or whether they happen to be large tracts of land or whether they happen to be intellectual property or whatever they might happen to be.
Well, the funds that were contributed by the holding company to the bank were assets of the bank.
Yeah, I understand. Well, I mean, there's some dispute about this tax refund, actually, so I'm not sure that's entirely
Well, the tax
conceded.
Refund is sort of a tangential aspect of it all.
Sounds like a lot of money, though.
Excuse me?
It sounds like a lot of money in terms of cash available to repay taxpayers for having bailed out this disaster. Mr. Lurie, if I could, I'd like to explore with you for a couple of minutes an alternative way of thinking about this problem.
Yes, yes,
I agree with you that Indiana law would govern classification between direct and derivative. I'll tell you, I don't see how 1, 2, 4, and 5 can be anything but derivative. With 3 and 7, the capital contributions and so on, if we were talking about a holding company that managed steel plants or restaurants, I would tend to agree with you. Those look like direct claims that the holding company might have against its own officers. But this is a bank, and I'd like to explore with you the governing statute here. Would you agree with me that a derivative claim is a claim of the corporation itself? It is a claim of the, in this case, of the bank.
Yes.
Okay.
The bank has the direct claim, and the shareholder
has only the derivative
can
claim.
Only bring right. it derivatively on behalf of the bank.
So we know that the FDIC as receiver steps into the shoes first of the bank, and therefore has the right to assert what would otherwise be derivative claims.
Yes.
Now, to the extent 3 and 7 may be a direct claim of a shareholder here. Let's look at the language of Section 1821 D2A, which is the critical language assigning to the FDIC as receiver certain rights. If it says it shall, as conservator or receiver, and by operation of law, succeed to all rights, titles, powers, and privileges of the insured depository institution. Now, that language would seem to me to be enough to get the FDIC all the derivative claims. That
yes,
is the
Your
point,
Honor.
Right? It goes on to say, and of any stockholder, member, account holder, et cetera, of such institution with respect to the institution and the assets of the institution. My question, in essence, is, given that assignment of claims belonging to stockholders with respect to the institution that has failed and that has been bailed out by the FDIC. Why does it matter whether we distinguish between direct and derivative claims for these purposes?
Because, Your Honor, I don't believe it's a correct interpretation of 12 U.S.C. Section 1821D2AI to interpret it as conferring on the FDIC every claim that belongs to a shareholder. If a shareholder
What work, then, does the language conferring on the FDIC all rights, titles, powers, and privileges of any stockholder with respect to the institution? What work does that language do?
I believe that language, the purpose of that language is to emphasize the fact that derivative claims can't be brought.
But we've agreed that language is not necessary for the FDIC to pursue what would be a derivative claim.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because it talks about all rights, titles, powers, and privileges of the insured depository institution and of any stockholder, member, account holder, deposit officer, or director of such institution with respect to the institution and the assets of the institution. And, Your Honor, if the shareholders, if you had a bank and the shareholders, public shareholders owned stock in a bank that wasn't held by a bank holding company, and those stockholders brought a claim against the officers and directors of the bank for securities fraud, alleging that they were defrauded into buying stock in the bank. Mm-hmm. And then the bank failed, and the FDIC attempted to contend that the FDIC owned the claims of the shareholders who claimed they were defrauded into investing in the bank. That clearly would not be a claim that belongs to the FDIC under FIREA.
Why not?
In particular, remember, we're talking here about putting, in essence, the taxpayers who pay for the bailout ahead of the shareholders who have presumably been profiting for a number of years. I mean, Irwin Financial had some great years, and the shareholders did very well. Taxpayers later had to bail them out. Why not put them ahead of the shareholders?
Well, Your Honor, as an initial proposition, the taxpayers don't pay for the bailout. The bailout is paid by the deposit insurance fund, and the deposit insurance fund is funded by fees paid by the bank.
And if there's a shortfall,
the banks are assessed.
Mm-hmm.
The banks are assessed fees.
And if they can't pay? This is the full faith and credit of the U.S. government behind these obligations, right?
It's the deposit insurance fund behind these obligations, and the network of insured banks in this country. It's not conceivable that with the J.P. Morgan Chases and the other banks, you know, in this country, that they will not be available for assessment to provide sufficient funds to the deposit insurance fund.
I hope you're not telling us that taxpayers never face any risk of liability in bailing out failed financial institutions after 2008 and 2009. Maybe I'm getting
To forget 2001 and 2002.
I'm getting carried away with my rhetoric, but we are talking about the government stepping in to fix a disaster. And why shouldn't that governmental entity step to the fore, marshal all the assets, including claims of stockholders, sort it all out later? Here we've got the problem of the one wasting insurance policy, right? The FDIC has chosen to sue some other folks, not the folks that you
and
want
that
to sue.
Wasting insurance policy is not an asset of the bank, and it's not an asset of the FDIC.
Whose is it?
It's an asset of defendants who are sued, who are insured under the D&O insurance policy.
Okay, and the FDIC also, by operation of law, succeeds to the rights, powers, privileges, and so on, of officers or directors of the institutions, right?
It does, Your Honor, but that doesn't mean that it succeeds to their rights in the insurance policies.
Why not?
The FDIC can't sue the insurance carrier without getting a judgment against the officers and directors.
Why not? This is why not give this statute a very robust reading in order to give the FDIC extraordinary powers?
Your Honor, the statute has never been accorded that reading. The FDIC has attempted.
I'm looking, sir, at the statutory language, which does not buy into the direct derivative distinction that so many cases have focused on.
Your Honor, I believe that this statute was passed and it was intended to mirror the provisions of the bankruptcy code with respect to a non-regulated entity that goes into bankruptcy.
Okay. Can you, which provisions of the bankruptcy
code? Section 541 of the bankruptcy code. Section 541 of the bankruptcy code says that an estate is created upon the commencement of a bankruptcy case, and that state goes into all of the assets of the bankrupt entity goes into that estate, and
right.
that means
and that was the that language. That's the effect of the language that was in place in 1821 before FERIA was passed, before this language was passed. It's much broader.
Your Honor, the FDIC has unsuccessfully attempted to argue that it's entitled to a priority ahead of shareholders who are bringing securities fraud actions against officers and directors of banks. And courts such as the court in Patel, a case cited in our reply brief, have held that FIREA does not extend to that extent and that that's not a proper interpretation of 12 U.S.C. section 1821
D2AI. Okay, the district court in Georgia, in Atlanta?
Yeah, Northern District of Georgia. The FDIC itself, in this case, says that Indiana state law determines whether or not the claims are direct or derivative. The FDIC says the law of India that says that the plaintiff is out of luck because the law of Indiana controls. And
it's actually federal law that controls here, right? It's actually federal law that controls under 1821, correct?
To the extent that 1821 D2AI extends, federal law controls. But federal law does not determine the parameters of a derivative action. If Your Honor's position is that Section 1821 D2AI was intended to give to the FDIC a direct claim that belongs to a stockholder, I respectfully disagree with that, and I don't believe that there is any authority that supports that proposition. I believe that if an asset, and the court in Lubin, the 11th Circuit said in Lubin, when the holding company, the trustee of the holding company, seeks to vindicate the rights of the holding company against its own officers, FIREA does not apply.
And it did not cite any statutory language for that conclusion.
Yes. It did refer to Section 1821 D2AI.
It did not address the language. We all know that the FDIC has always been able to step, well, since it was created, has been able to step into the shoes of the institution itself. The question is whether FIREA broadened that power.
I think it's clear from the Lubin case that the 11th Circuit did not interpret 12 U.S.C. 1821 D2AI as giving the FDIC the assets of the holding company. If that was the case, then every penny and every asset that the holding company owned on the date that the FDIC was appointed receiver would become an asset of the receivership estate.
If it's an asset
and
with
that
respect
does not
to the
happen.
Institution. If it's an asset with respect to the institution.
Well, the holding company owns the institution.
Yeah.
In addition to the count two claim.
Thank you, counsel.
Excuse me.
Thank you, counsel.
Oh, thank you.
Ms. Van Say.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Minodora Vencia, counsel for Appalachia FDIC as receiver for the two failed banks. I would like to address first Judge Hamilton's question about the statute. FDIC is not relying here on the statute because we think we don't need to rely on the statute because we think we win under Indiana law. But I think you asked a very good question, which is, what does the second part of the statute do if the first part already gives the FDIC already what rights the bank had under state law? And I would say that what it does, you know, under regular corporate law, when the corporation refuses shareholders' demand for a derivative action, sometimes shareholders can still pursue that action.
So it gives the stockholder rights that a stockholder would have, including the right to bring a derivative action when the necessary prerequisites are established.
Yeah, so that section takes away that right to bring
the derivative. And now it goes to the FDIC.
Even if the shareholders would have had it under normal corporate law. But I don't think the FDIC is prepared to take a position, and that's why I'm not authorized to say here that actually direct actions belong to us, because,
if you're not going to take that line, then I'm interested in what your view is about whether the FDIC owns the kind of claim that the holding company has labeled Count 7. That is, the claim that the holding company's directors threw good money after bad. Does the FDIC own that claim?
Your Honor, that's not the totality of that claim. And the actual language they used, they said that
Suppose it is.
Take that characterization. I'm not worried about totalities. I'm worried about does the FDIC claim that it can recover $14 million on the theory that the holding company invested $14 million too much in the banks? Is that a ground on which the FDIC can recover?
No, I think as to their specific allegation, which is under their own words, is that there was no prospect that the bank would be safe.
Why don't you answer the Chief Judge's question?
Just answer the question that I asked.
Then we can move on.
Right. As I understand 1821, it's trying to partition claims between what the FDIC owns and what other people own. So I'm trying to get at this question by whether the FDIC claims that it owns a contention, a legal right of recovery, based on a contention that the holding company invested too much in the banks.
If the chain challenges the wisdom of the investment in the bank, we don't contend that we own it.
All right, so you would agree then, this is along a line of hypotheticals I was thinking of, it is not uncommon for somebody to sue the corporation for imprudent investments. You buy a parcel of land that turns out to be riddled with environmental damages, you in other ways throw money out the window, and it's hard to see how that is a claim at the bank level as opposed to at the holding company level. In other words, why it isn't something that's just a direct claim against these people who are running the holding company.
To the extent that the challenges to the wisdom of the investment, it's true. However, here there are also allegations. They reincorporate parts of the complaint in which they challenge the management decisions taken at the bank level.
That problem can be very easily fixed by repleting.
Yeah, sure.
And which these plaintiffs never had a chance to do with counts 3 and 7.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would like to go back to count 3 later because I think
count 7,
totally
as it now stands, says that Miller and Ellinger breached duties of loyalty and care by, as they say, by capitulating to bank regulators and making capital contributions to a bad investment, a doomed bank, either already fully doomed or almost doomed or, you know, somewhere on the downward slide. And I would just disregard the capitulating to bank regulators language. I don't see what that adds to anything. It's just making bad contributions. And I don't see why that isn't the same thing as saying you put a lot of dollar bills in a large container and sank it to the bottom of the ocean. I mean, that would be a stupid thing to do with the company's money.
you would have a good position under 1821 if that created a claim in the banks that FDIC could step into.
Yes, Your Honor.
But as soon as you say the banks don't have any claim and there's nothing for FDIC to step into, then you've got Judge Wood's characterization, that it's just sinking money into the ocean.
But here we are challenging this on plausibility, on failure to state a claim.
Well, now you're switching to a completely different theory.
Yeah. It may be a stupid claim. It may fail on motion under 12b-6, but that's not the ground on which the district court dismissed it, right? The directors, if this goes forward, the directors are going to go, business judgment rule, go away. And, of course, that might be exactly what happens, but we haven't reached that stage yet.
Your Honor, we believe that under the failure to state a claim standards we have, because their allegation is that at the time these investments were made, there was no prospect that the bank would be saved. And at the time the first investment was made, the bank was well capitalized.
But you have Twombly-Iqbal issues there. I mean, my initial reaction to this was exactly what Judge Easterbrook just said. In count seven, you're challenging the imprudent making of an investment. The business judgment rule is front and center in that kind of claim.
Yeah.
But, we're not there. I'm a little reluctant to bring in all this extra stuff that you're talking about, given the fact that as we evaluate complaints, we need to take them in a reasonable light, favorable to the party who's pleading the complaint.
Not if they're contradicted by allegations
in
the
complaint. Wait a second, though. The only federal judicial officer who ruled on whether counts 3 and 7 plausibly state claims ruled that they did.
Right.
Now, if the district judge or we disagree with that, presumably, given all the uncertainty about Iqbal and Twombly standards, and then it would be appropriate to give the plaintiffs an opportunity to replead to see if they can fix those problems that you're relying on, all the incorporation by reference of all the problems with the banks and so on. Now, maybe they can, maybe they can't, but that makes for more litigation rather than a dismissal at this stage.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. But I would like to go to count 3 because I think it's materially distinguishable from count 7, because unlike count 7, it does not allege the misconduct on which it's based is not a misconduct that occurred at the holding company level. In count 3, they allege that they made the imprudent dividend payments and repurchases of capital because they were misinformed by how bad the condition of the bank was and the cause of that misinformation they alleged.
So let me recharacterize count 3 a little differently from the way you're describing it. They say that the defendants failed to implement effective internal controls at the holding company, and that failure led to a lot of bad actions. But suppose what the defendants decided to do, and this is completely hypothetical, I'm sure they didn't, but anyway, suppose they decided to say, we don't want to waste money on auditors, so we just won't bother ever to audit the books or find out how much money we have. We're just going to send it out whenever we feel like it. Well, that is certainly a problem at the holding company level. And in fact, as you know, there are in fact a plethora of rules about the need for independent audit committees and the need for certain kinds of financial controls at banks. There are regulations galore. There are all sorts of things. But I think that's what they're trying to say. I think they're trying to say the internal devices that the holding company used that are designed to elicit relevant information were faulty. And if that's true, why isn't that a holding company problem? Faulty controls then do lead to other bad effects, but I don't see why that's pertinent.
Because the faultiness, the bad financial reporting was about the allowance for lease losses at the bank level and about the loans held for sale at the bank level. There's nothing the holding company can do about that.
Well, yes, there is. The holding company can say, we are going to audit our books. You know, how often are we getting reports from our assets, namely the banks?
We're going to raise more capital.
Yeah, we're going to raise more capital. There are many things that the holding company can do. Yes, the topic is about what's going on inside these assets, just as though the topic might be, you know, have you done environmental remediation on land? But in the end, it's What are the information-producing devices at the holding company level that allow them to take sensible financial decisions?
There's nothing that a holding company can do to fix the bad internal controls at the bank.
No, no, I agree with that, and that's one of the other counts. But the holding
company
can...
No, that's count three.
The holding company can... You're describing count one, I think.
No, I'm talking about count three. Count three is based on the failure in internal control at the bank level. That's why.
No, it's not at the bank level. They say at the holding company level. And you're pretending that the holding company doesn't have any internal controls of its own.
It does. For instance, it has to properly reconcile its own projections with the bank projections.
Sure, and it needs to collect information and audit things. And
but when it gets bad information from the bank, there's nothing it can do to fix
of
that.
Of course, except honestly report that bad information to the director.
But it has
so
no way of knowing whether it's good or bad because it's all at the bank level.
I'm not sure about that. They're saying that... You're saying that operating with a blindfold on is the same as operating with your eyes open and suspecting that something's wrong. But I think they're saying there was a blindfold, which is irresponsible. Again, I don't know what they were doing. But, I mean, what they're saying is that they failed to implement effective controls at the holding company level.
When the holding company is a shell, it necessarily has... It only has the information from the bank.
But that's
it's all about all the losses that they weren't able to predict, that they couldn't paint the accurate picture of the financial situation of
the
holding company.
Suppose they never
and the
asked the banks at all for any information, just to take an extreme case. And they went ahead and, you know, just kind of deposited money when they got it. Surely that's not a bank-level problem. It's their problem because they never asked.
If that was the account they alleged, then perhaps yes. If it was,
is the account they alleged. Failed to implement effective internal controls at the holding company
to
level.
To give them a proper picture of the of how bad the holding company situation was, and the holding company situation was bad because the bank situation was bad because the bank didn't properly account for loan losses.
Right, but the argument is that IFC was worse off than it would have been. Assume the banks continue to do badly. The claim is that IFC, the holding company, is worse off than it would have been because of foolish decisions to pay dividends and to repurchase stock, right? Now, that doesn't hurt the bank subsidiaries at all. The argument is that it hurt the holding company.
The
and it was a decision that could be made only at the holding company level.
The test is not whether the injury is unique to the holding company. It's whether the injury is indirect, where it depends on harm at the bank level and misconduct at the bank level.
And
count three has both harm at the bank level and misconduct at the bank level. There's no misconduct per se that only occurred at the holding company level,
sure,
unlike count seven.
Sure there is. Presented with inaccurate financial information, the IFC board made decisions that were detrimental to IFC, the holding company.
Yes, but inaccurate financial information was the bank's inaccurate financial information.
So
the holding
what?
Company didn't have information. There's nothing that they say.
So what?
Like if it was an allegation, for instance, the bank reported $10 million in profits, and the holding company directors misread as $100 million, and based on that error, they issued dividends, then we wouldn't challenge that. But that's not what this complaint says, that they misread the information the bank gave them. The complaint here is about the problems at the bank level that were caused inaccurate financial reporting.
Could the banks sue these individual defendants for having made imprudent distributions of dividends at the holding company level?
No, but they could sue them for the underlying for the.
Yeah,
for
that's
the
a different claim.
But they would still be put in the if the bank recovered, they would be in the same position. They would sue them for the internal control failures.
The money would be recovered for the benefit of the holding company, which could do with it what it wanted. Right.
Yes, but that's not a test. If you believe that your investment in the bank is sound and then you go buy a Toyota and the bank fails because of mismanagement at the bank level, you can't say, oh, my harm is my Toyota because I bought the Toyota. But that's basically what they're arguing here. if the bank sues to recover for the mismanagement, you're put in the same position.
I would agree there is at least a certain irony in what would ultimately be shareholders' claims to the effect that the management paid them too much in dividends. So.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Naur.
Morning, honored judges, counsel. When we were getting ready to split up our time, I talked to Ms. Vancia, and her comment to me, which I thought was quite valid, is that since my clients, the three named defendants, were arguing that these claims belong to the FDIC, who better than to present the bulk of those arguments to the court but the FDIC itself, and so we ceded a lot of our time to them. I wanted to just...
You just heard the FDIC's lawyers say effectively that it can't bring either count 3 or count 7. The claim that the holding company invested too much in the banks or it paid excessive dividends to its shareholders because of bad internal controls, neither one states any loss to the banks and therefore doesn't fall into the FDIC's hands. Now, why doesn't it follow from that it still belongs to that those claims still belong to the holding company?
Principally, I'd suggest to you, Judge, that this court, in the case of Massey versus Merrill Lynch,
I didn't ask you anything about this court. I asked you for a functional explanation about why 1821 blocks claims that the FDIC concedes it cannot bring.
I heard Judge Hamilton certainly commenting on that this morning, and I, frankly, we didn't argue that. And
I'm not asking about Judge Hamilton's position.
My exploration.
Your exploration.
Exactly.
Why it blocks those claims?
Count 3 and Count 7 both state losses to the holding company.
Yes.
Without any apparent loss to the banks. The FDIC is allocated any loss to the banks. FDIC can sue for any loss to the banks, whether that's called direct or derivative or whether it's called Phil or Banana Sunday. Names don't matter. The FDIC gets all claims related to loss to the banks. The FDIC's lawyer just said, but counts 3 and 7, if they're understood the way the trustee would like to understand them, don't state any loss to the banks, so they're not in our bailiwick. My question to you is, why doesn't it follow from that they are retained by the trustee?
I think that it doesn't follow from that because the loss of an investment under Massey versus Merrill Lynch is deemed to be a derivative claim. At least that's the way I read the case.
I was asking you to give a reason, and all you're doing is telling me how you read a case.
Well, if I think what you're saying to me, if it does every claim, does every wrong have to have a remedy? And if so, isn't the remedy only with the holding company? And
whether there is a remedy,
on the loss of
whether
value,
there is a remedy will depend on state law. And as both Judge Wood and I have said, Counts 3 and 7 may go away very quickly under the business judgment rule. What we're talking about now is who owns whatever claim there is. And it seems to me that the option no one owns the claim, that it's been vaporized, is not what 1821 says or does. 1821 is trying to allocate claims between the FDIC and their original owners. It's not trying to abolish claims that are otherwise sound claims under state law. And if the FDIC says, doesn't belong to us, one would think the answer is, well, then it still belongs to its original owner for whatever it's worth, which may be very little. What's wrong with that position?
All I can understand about a claim like you're describing is, yes, it belongs to the holding, it belongs to the holding company, but it's still a derivative claim because it's based on the loss of value of an investment.
Well, no, I mean, that doesn't make a claim derivative.
It's a shared. If it's derivative, it's shared.
No, derivative doesn't mean shared. That's that occurs through the arguments here. Derivative means it's a claim that belongs to somebody else, but there's a legal relationship that allows a third party to come in and assert that claim, whether it's, you know, your classic shareholder derivative action, asserting a claim on behalf of the corporation, or key TAM action, asserting a claim on behalf of the United States, or there are any number of derivative actions that appear in the law. What you're confusing is the fact that, say, when an asset suffers, the owner of that asset is likely also to have some damage that flows from that, but it's the source of the damage. And here, you may simply be in a world where it's 12b-6 that needs to be invoked to assess this going forward. As Judge Hamilton has pointed out, you know, the magistrate judge thought under that kind of a standard, 3 and 7 survive. We haven't gotten down that road yet at the district court, and I make no predictions at all about what will happen. Fortunately, that's not before us today, at least as far as I'm concerned it isn't, because nobody was really pushing it. But I just don't see why the fact that there's some overlap in the factual events means that everything has to be called, a claim that the FDIC can assert. I don't see any language of FIREA that says the claims vaporize. I think, as Judge Easterbrook says, it's an allocation statute.
I don't know that I have anything further that I can answer your question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.